All right, so Yoav started with a disclaimer yesterday that he wasn't a population geneticist, so I'm not sure if I'm a population geneticist or not, but I was happy on Monday when people introduced themselves, and a common answer around the room was I'm interested in regulatory networks and their evolution or something like that, because that's what I'm interested in. And before I start, I just want to acknowledge Sasha Levy, who's a postdoc in my lab, who did all of the work I'm going to present today. He's a graduate of UCSB, so I also want to thank Santa Barbara for sending him my way. He's a really, really super scientist. So I think it's safe to say that everyone in this room is interested in some way in what we call the genotype-phenotype map. That is to say that there's some complicated space of possible genotypes and complicated space of possible phenotypes, and we're interested in how those two relate to one another. And population geneticists have obviously thought about this for a really long time, and usually their response is to build theoretical constructs that simplify this as much as possible so that equations can be written down. Quantitative geneticists do the same thing with slightly less simplification. Molecular biologists and developmental biologists, in a sense, their job is to figure out how genotypes become phenotypes. Systems biologists, you know, obviously are thinking about the same things. And I think it's also safe to say that, in general, we know very, very, very little about the mapping of genotype to phenotype. But we can say certain things about general properties that we think this mapping has. And one of those properties is something that you might call homeostasis or environmental robustness. That is, if you start with, say, a clone of organisms with the same genotype, that we can expect fairly reliably that they'll all end up with very similar phenotypes, and despite experiencing, say, variation in the environments in which they develop. Or during their adult lifetimes, there are regulatory mechanisms that sort of return organisms to their sort of destined fates. The usual counterargument to this is phenotypic plasticity. That is, there are certain organisms, particularly people bring up plants, that respond to different environments with different phenotypic outputs, and so that would certainly not give you always one genotype leading to one phenotype. But I think an underappreciated point is that typically these plastic responses are not rheostats. They're not sort of mapping slight changes in environment onto slight changes in phenotype. They're usually changing from discrete fate to discrete fate. So even though the number of possible phenotypic outcomes might be bigger than one for a particular genotype, it's not infinite. And so each particular fate that organisms end up in somehow also has regulatory homeostatic controls. The other thing I think we can say with some assurance is that there's some degree of genetic robustness. That is, that a relatively larger space, obviously it's unclear how you might measure these things, a large space in genotype space can map to a very small space in phenotype space. That is, many genotypes can give you essentially the same phenotype. And so that's what I'm representing here. This obviously can have enormous evolutionary implications. It can determine how genotype space is explored. That is, if the space is as I've drawn it here, where the genotypes that lead to the same phenotype are fairly contiguous, right? Then that suggests that there can be a lot of genotypic drift underlying the same phenotype, and more of that genotype space is explored. Whereas if these things are interspersed, that is, neighboring points in genotype space might give you wildly different phenotypes, then that might constrain the amount of drift that a particular genotype can undergo, because all of its neighbors might be different. And there are different ways people have theorized about this. Eric, for example, has developed neutral network models that sort of encapsulate this, and other people have approached it in different ways. But I think this notion of genetic robustness and how this mapping actually is structured is a really, really important idea in evolutionary biology. And it's been thought about for a really long time. So a lot of people trace ideas like this back to Hal Waddington, who developed this visual metaphor of the epigenetic landscape, where what he envisioned was development or a developing organism was like a ball rolling down a slightly inclined plane with channels carved in it. And so each of these bifurcation points represents some kind of fate decision. And so the ball sort of rolls down as it will. But once it's in a channel, it's very hard to perturb it out of that channel. And the perturbations he was considering were either genetic perturbations or environmental perturbations. And the notion is that there are a set of discrete states, a set of discrete outcomes for this developmental process. And you don't have a continuous range of outcomes. And therefore, these channels represent sort of robust states or attractor states that the developing organism will find itself in. So Waddington was very much ahead of his time, in my opinion. A lot of people have seen this picture, right? Not as many people have seen this next picture, which is his depiction of what's underlying this landscape. Okay, and so his vision of what was underneath this epigenetic landscape, giving it its shape, was a very complex network of interactions. And so a diagram like this would be just at home in 2008 as it was in 1957. In fact, it's more at home now than it was then. A lot of people didn't pay much attention to Waddington because they thought his ideas were kind of crazy. He was clear that what he saw was a network of interacting genes and gene products that gave this landscape its shape. And so, as I said, his ideas were sort of controversial. He had this tendency to be fairly iconoclastic and sort of invite people to disagree with him. There were a few laughs of recognition, maybe, I don't know. So his ideas, they've always been around, but they really didn't quite get reinvigorated until about 10 years ago when Susanna Rutherford and Susan Lindquist made a discovery about a molecular chaperone called HSP90 that excited a lot of people, both pro and con, against their results and their interpretation. So what they found was, in a sense, a very simple observation. That is, if you had different strains of Drosophila and you introduced into each one a mutation in this molecular chaperone encoding gene, HSP90, that in different strains you would get a different phenotypic outcome. So in one strain, you would get some proportion of flies with messed up eyes. Another strain, you'd get messed up eyes in a slightly different way. In another strain, you'd get messed up abdomen. In another strain, you'd get messed up wings and some proportion of the flies in that strain. And so their interpretation was that the normal role of HSP90 was to buffer this variation, this genetic variation, because it's a strain-specific effect that you see. And that impairment of this buffer was a way of generating phenotypic variability that might be used by natural selection, for example. And because HSP90 is a heat shock protein, it's a stress responsive protein, and because under high stress its activity can be overwhelmed by the job it has to do and breaks down, there is this sort of natural tie between environmental conditions which might require a new phenotypic response and the generation of greater variability. And so they promoted this idea and they termed HSP90 a phenotypic capacitor, which implies that its normal role is to buffer variation, so this variation can build up, but it can also be released when the buffer fails. And so I'm going to be using this term capacitor through the talk, and that's one of the reasons I want to introduce it. But the question then arises is HSP90 the one buffering molecule, or are there many? And if you take a Waddingtonian perspective, you might expect that there would be many aspects to a robust system and not just one. And so the question then becomes, is HSP90 just one of these genes holding down this epigenetic landscape? And if we do a systematic search, will we find many more such genes? Or is there something indeed special about HSP90? So this question also arose out of some modeling work that I had done with Aviv Bergman, where we modeled a very, very simple transcriptional regulatory network. and let it evolve under sort of a standard population genetic process, mutation, selection, mating, and so on. And the prediction that came out of that modeling is that indeed a lot of genes would have this property of buffering variation, and then when you knock them out, you would see that they had that role because you would see greater phenotypic variation. And so we really wanted to test this in an organism in a very systematic way, because if your prediction is that this phenomenon should be widespread, then you have to test many, many genes. And so I thought about it for about 5 minutes and realized that it would be impossible to do this experiment in flies, because essentially what you want is a large number of genotypes that you've precisely engineered to be, say, mutations in each gene in a very well-controlled set of genetic backgrounds, and just doing that work in flies would be prohibitively difficult. But there are organisms where we can conceive of doing experiments like that. And the organism we settled upon when Sasha joined my lab was the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And so our goal then was to systematically screen the entire genome of this organism for genes that are required to maintain robustness. Okay? So basically to do the HSP90 test, not on one gene, not on a handful of genes, but on every gene. And then if we could indeed find a large number of such genes, then we could start asking really interesting questions like, what do they have in common? What makes them have this property whereas other genes don't have this property? And so the other advantage, as I'll sort of list on the next slide, of using yeast is that there are a lot of data sets out there that we can compare our results to and make these correlations. So the advantages of yeast as a model organism, some of which I've talked about already, first of all, is that a lot of the reagents we would want to use are already available. So, for example, there's a comprehensive collection of knockout strains for each non-essential yeast gene in the same genetic background. So that's 4,700 yeast strains. They take up a space in your freezer about this big, right? So it's not a unmanageable thing to handle. As I said, there are many high-throughput genome-wide data sets available for yeast that measure things like the growth rates of these strains when each gene is knocked out, the number of genetic and protein-protein interactions for each gene, and many, many studies of gene expression of every gene across a wide variety of conditions. And obviously, yeasts are easy to use in the lab. They have a 2-hour generation time approximately, so you can do lots of experiments fairly quickly. The main disadvantage of using yeast as a model system for studying phenotypic robustness is it's hard to say what a phenotype is for yeast. Most of the phenotypes we associate with yeast are population properties. So, for example, the morphology of a colony on a plate is not a property of individual cells, it's a property of a community of cells. The growth rate of a population is not really an individual property, it's a property that we measure on average across a large population. And in order to study phenotypic variation, we need to somehow be able to measure things about individual cells. And so we were fortunate in that as we were sort of trying to consider these experiments, the Oya and Morishita labs at the University of Tokyo developed a really great method and actually a really great data set for us to use to do this. And so what they did was they developed a protocol where they grow cells in liquid culture, exponential phase. They fix them and then they stain them with a marker for the cell surface, which is concanavalin A, a marker for the nucleus, which is just DAPI, and a marker for the actin cytoskeleton, which is phalloidin. And so they take these fluorescent images, they develop their own custom image analysis software to basically find cells, find landmarks on those cells, and measure all kinds of things about the cells, like the long axis of the mother cell, the short axis, the bud axis, measurements about the nuclei, as well as the cell outline, the angle of the bud to the mother. And in total, they measured 220 quantitative phenotypes about these cells. As I'll show you, not all of those phenotypes are independent of one another, as you might expect. You know, for example, if you're measuring the long axis of the cell and the short axis of the cell, you can expect that those are going to be correlated with each other. So one of the tasks in analyzing these data is to do some kind of dimensional reduction so you're not counting the same thing over and over again. Anyone have a question? And so what was nice about their experiments is that not only did they develop this method, but they applied it to every single one of these 4,700 knockout strains. So their data set includes morphological data on hundreds of cells per genotype for 4,700 genotypes. And so we get really good measurements of the mean and the variance of these phenotypes. And so we could mine these data to find genes that, when they're knocked out, give you more morphological variation. And I just want to take a brief moment to review what the possible sources of variation we're looking at in this particular experiment. So this is my sort of cartoon version of the all of the possible sources of variation in a yeast culture. So you can imagine, say, that two different yeast cells in the same culture have different genotypes, either because you seeded different genotypes into that same culture or because of mutation, a new genotype has arisen. So potentially there's genetic variation between cells in the same culture. There's potentially what I would call macro-environmental variation between cultures. So these different colors are meant to represent different nutrient concentrations or toxin concentrations or temperatures or whatever environmental variable that you can control. But in addition to those macro-environmental variations that we can say are sort of set by the experiment, there are also micro-environmental differences. So two genetically identical cells in the same culture might experience slightly different environments depending on how close they are to the surface, who their neighbors are. Even in a well-shaken flask of yeast, no two cells are going to experience exactly the same series of microenvironments. And so there are potentially differences in the cells that we can't really control in our experiments that are microenvironmental. And in addition, there are stochastic effects that are due to the fact that many biological molecules are present in small numbers. And so if you have, say, an RNA or a protein that is present in a low copy number, those get partitioned in the cytoplasm during cell division, that there are stochastic effects there, that they're not getting an equal number of that gene product when the cells divide. And so there's the potential for variation to be introduced just by the stochastic nature of life itself. So in the experiments that I'm talking about today, the cells were within each strain, so within each knockout strain, the cells are isogenic. So there's no genetic variation, at least at the start. And we did our experiments, our follow-up experiments, in such a way that we minimize the possibility that new mutations were actually in those strains, because we limited the number of generations these things were dividing before we assayed them. And there's no macro-environmental variation. All of the cells are grown in sort of the standard laboratory medium, rich medium for yeast. So that leaves us with two possible sources of variation: micro-environmental variation, stochastic variation, that we really can't tell apart in these experiments, although possibly towards the end we can talk about the directions we're going, that we think we can start to ask questions about inheritance of phenotypic states and sort of partition out these inheritance effects from just random effects.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
These phenotypes that you want to analyze, in a way, there seems to be a snapshot in time of the budding yeast. So in what sense do you actually look at different, for budding yeast instead of phenotype?
Right. So one of the things that the image analysis does is it bins the cells into approximate ages, and it does it very crudely, admittedly. So it separates out cells with no buds from cells with small buds from cells with large buds. Okay, that's how good it does in sort of taking this asynchronous culture and dividing it. We're trying to develop new methods where we're actually looking at live cells as they divide and use fluorescent markers that are timers for the cell cycle, and that will allow us to do a much better job of that. But that's definitely true that we're dealing with an asynchronous culture, and so the comparisons are sort of limited by the fact that these bins are fairly crude. That said, we think it's not too much of a problem if you assay enough cells. Even if, you know, I would worry about it if we were assaying a small number of cells, because you might be catching a cell just in one of these snapshots at a very early stage in the cell cycle, and then in your next snapshot in a different genotype, you'd be catching a cell very late in the cell cycle, and you'd be inferring some variance there that really wasn't true. But I think if you get a large number of cells, you're getting a snapshot that really represents all of the stages through the cell cycle, and it's less of a problem.
But the variance measure might be a measure then of how much morphological variance there is along the cell cycle, right?
So what do you mean by along?
Between different individuals in the same population, right? So there's one measure of variation that says you take different guys and they have a different shape,
right?
Because they vary. But it may also be that if you follow one guy through time, its shape may vary a lot as it goes through the cell cycle. And they all vary in exactly the same way, different guys in the population. And those two things are
I mean, I guess,
in your measurement.
Right. Although I guess one of the things I would argue that would argue against that is a lot of these measurements are sizes, they're lengths. And so the cells are not sort of growing, shrinking. Right. So that would be a kind of variation that you're describing, where through the cell cycle it does this accordion thing. But even if every cell does the same thing, you might be measuring that as variation. But as far as anyone could say about yeast, they don't do that. They sort of progress in size. Right. So I don't know. You look skeptical. In our view, the difficulties of dealing with this set of data were three main difficulties that I'll sort of summarize here, and then I can go through, and you can tell me if it's too boring to go through in detail. But so the first main problem you have to deal with when measuring and comparing variances is that they depend on means typically, and they don't do so in a very predictable way. So oftentimes what you'll see is when people are trying to compare variances, they use a coefficient of variation, so they divide the standard deviation by the mean as some way of controlling for some scaling effect of an increase in standard deviation as the mean increases. But in general, there's no reason to expect in any particular case that that's what the relationship's going to be, a linear relationship between standard deviation and mean. And so we have to somehow take that into account, or else we're going to confound a change in mean with a change in variance. And so we're not trying to detect things that change their mean, we're trying to detect things that change their variance. So we have to somehow control for that non-trivial, usually nonlinear relationship between variance and mean, and so we use a low-S regression method that's sort of the same kind of thing people use for microarray data to straighten out dye biases, and then we use residuals to that regression to sort of take out the effect of this relationship between standard deviation and mean, and I'll show you some examples of that.
You might have the linear relationship between mean and variance, right?
Well, no. So if you're taking residuals, you're left with no relationship. Yeah.
How do you actually know for sure that this signal you want to throw away? I mean, maybe it is true that there just happens to be a correlation between one variable being larger in mean and showing bigger variation, and this is just bigger variation is bigger variation.
Right. So, I mean, the thing we don't know ahead of time, the ultimate question is what proportion of this variation is meaningful to natural selection, right? That's the ultimate question.
Yes.
And we don't know if if you have a certain amount of variation around a mean here that's wide compared to other variation around that mean, other genotypes variation around that mean is more relevant than changing to a different mean, and by virtue of changing to a different mean, you get a bigger variation because we don't know which parts of that distribution are actually adaptive, right? And so you have to make some kind of decision, and we think it's, at least for a first pass, a reasonable thing to say is we want to pick out things that are more variable given their mean. It might be true that the relevant things in the end are going to be changes in mean because they give you a change in variance. But that would be an assumption, and if we go with that assumption, then I think we're open to a lot of criticism that we're not really measuring changes in variance. So we are stuck in a bind there, and we've made the decision to go for changes in variance given your mean. So the second problem we had to deal with, which I've already mentioned, is dimensional reduction. So these phenotypes are not independent of one another. For example, the major axis and the minor axis of the cell. And so we have to do some kind of dimensional reduction, and we use a clustering strategy to do that called partitioning around medioids. And then finally, the last thing we have to do is take this matrix of phenotypic variances by genes, and then for each gene basically rank it somehow and say this gene when knocked out gives you more variance than this other gene, right? So we need like a single score for each gene, and we need to get some kind of significance level for that score. And so we use a kind of averaging procedure to do that, averaging across the variances but not across all of the variances, as you'll see. And we get a significance for that score just by permuting the columns in this matrix and repeating the analysis.
So that's still, do you make the assumption that the variance is the variance regardless of the phenotype, you measure it in numbers and it has the same meaning?
So we do normalize these columns so that they're all sort of contributing the same amount or potentially contributing the same amount to the ultimate score. So they're all in different units, right? Standard deviations are in the same units as their mean, right? But we normalize them so that at least numerically they're all contributing on average the same to the final score.
But in that matrix you put ranks, right? Or you put actual numbers.
So this matrix is actual numbers. It's the residuals from this regression. And then we average across, and then we get scores. But the point I was making is just that in the end, we want these scores to mean something, that the high score is high variance and low score is low variance, and then we have to put a cutoff somewhere to say which ones are significant.
So it's one number per gene per phenotype?
Yeah, so let me actually go through it, because I sort of step through these things. This is just an example of two phenotypes showing that the standard deviation is dependent on the mean, and it's not always dependent in a linear way. So this is the butt angle, and you can see that the standard deviation in general increases with the mean. This is the maximum distance between actin patches in the cell, and this is something that peaks at intermediate means. And so the point is what we decided was important was to be able to say not that something necessarily just has a high standard deviation, but it has a high standard deviation given what its mean tells you if that standard deviation would normally be for the bulk of genes. So as I said, the way we do this is we fit a smooth regression through the bulk of the data, through all the data, and take residuals from that regression line as our measure of standard deviation controlled for this trend with mean. So those residuals enter into this data matrix, right? So we have 4,700 genes by 220 phenotypes. The residuals go in, the columns get normalized, and then we do dimensional reduction to get down from 220 phenotypes to some number of phenotypes that are relatively independent from one another. You can't use principal components analysis to do that because it doesn't preserve the syntax of these residuals as a sign. So if you use principal components analysis on this matrix, you would get obviously linear combinations of your original phenotypes, but the loadings on those would have either positive, the coefficients would either be positive or negative, and so you'd be messing up the thing you were originally trying to find, which is increases in variance, because in one column an increase in variance might get a negative sign. And so that principal component would then be a mix of those and would not really tell you what you were looking for. So instead what we did was to use partitioning around medioids, which is a robust variant of k-means clustering. So you can imagine that you have this high dimensional space where each axis is a gene, and then these phenotypes land somewhere in that space and they're clustered. And so your task is to identify the separated clusters. And so you say, okay, I want three clusters, and then it finds you three clusters. But you, because you're telling it how many clusters you want from the beginning, you need some way of evaluating whether that was the right number of clusters. So you repeat this for every number of clusters, and you use what's called a silhouette width to tell if you're doing that well. So the way that works is partitioning around medioids, one of the nice things about it is instead of getting a linear combination of phenotypes, in the end you get the most representative phenotype, the median phenotype for that cluster. So your reduced dimensional matrix actually has actual phenotypes still in it, which are easier to interpret than, you know, some linear combination of things. And then the silhouette width is just a measure of how far apart these red guys are to blue guys compared to how far apart the red guys are to each other. And so when you maximize that, you have a good separation of clusters. And so if you plot the average silhouette width for our data, it starts to level out at about 70 clusters. So instead of using all 220 phenotypes, we're using 70 phenotypes. And as I'll show you, you know, obviously this is a semi-arbitrary decision you're making, and so we checked for a wide range of number of clusters to use to make sure that we keep getting the same list of genes out in the end. That is, that the method is robust to these decisions we're making. So then what we have is this same matrix, except now we're only using 70 representative phenotypes, and these still are the residuals of standard deviation, and we average across the top half of these rows. And so again, that's a semi-arbitrary decision to make, but it goes to what our definition of a phenotypic capacitor is. So what we wanted was a definition that says a mutation in one of these genes tends to cause broadly increases in variation. Not that it's increasing the variation of one phenotype, but it tends to increase variation in phenotypes in general. It would be way too stringent to average across the whole thing, because that would sort of enforce that every phenotype has to increase in variance when this gene is knocked out, which is kind of unrealistic. And it would, in the end, what it does is it sort of introduces noise, because you're averaging across too many things.
How do you measure distance in the original clustering procedure? Because many of those phenotypes are highly correlated, probably.
Well, that's exactly that.
When you do this medioids, right? So you have to maximize the ratio of distance to other clusters to overall distance within the cluster.
Right.
So what's the notion of distance here?
It's just a Euclidean distance.
Euclidean distance, yeah. But you normalize by covariance between or you don't.
So within each column, you mean?
Yes.
You're normalizing to the same amount of variation within each column.
Right, but then if you have highly correlated variables, potentially, so imagine you measure the same almost the same phenotype many, many, many times. So it would completely dominate your partitioning, or it's not correct.
It would just cluster those phenotypes.
He's clustering the phenotypes. He's clustering the variables. He's not clustering.
Not clustering the genes.
The gene. Okay, so it doesn't matter for the matter what he. Okay.
Thanks. So as I was saying, we average the top half of the medioids instead of all of them, and we can go back and inspect this decision in two ways. One is we again vary this across a wide range of how many we're averaging and make sure that the results don't change that much. And the other thing is we went back and looked and saw how many knockouts cause increased variation in just a really large number of medioids. And there are a few, but they all end up on the list in the end anyway. So we're not sort of losing those somehow. Then in the end, what we get is a score for each gene. And so in the orange is the histogram of these scores. We call this score phenotypic potential. This sort of go along with this phenotypic capacitor lingo. And so these phenotypic potential scores are in this orange histogram, and then there are 100 gray histograms that are superimposed on each other here that are randomizations of the data and recalculating of the scores. And so, so what I hope you can see is that the real data, the orange histogram, has this heavy right-hand tail. And so what that means is that there are scores, phenotypic potential scores, out here that are much higher than you ever expect to see by chance. And so these are the knockouts that we call phenotypic capacitors significantly. And so we can use these permutations to estimate the false discovery rate, and our estimate at sort of the false discovery rate that maximizes the number of true positives is that there are somewhere around 330 true positives here. And at that false discovery rate, you have to declare that about 500 genes are positive, so we have about a 33% false discovery rate. But in the analyses that I'll show you afterwards, we're using that list of 500 genes as our list of capacitors, even though we know that there's about 30% false discovery rate for that set. So I just want to show you real quick that what I said was true. So we redid the analysis varying the number of clusters that we use. So instead of 70 phenotypic medioids, we're using anywhere from 50 to 80. And this is just a correlation plot. If you take the top 502 genes using 70 clusters and compare that to using 50 clusters, what percentage of the genes are the same in those lists? That's just an indication of how robust the method is to these arbitrary decisions we're making. And you can see the scale goes from 80% to 100%. So pretty much over this very wide range, we're getting the same list of genes over and over again. We're not making arbitrary decisions that drastically change the results of the analysis. And we can do the same thing with how many we average. So if we take, instead of averaging 35 out of the 70, we take 60 or we take 10. Again, what you can see, this range is slightly wider, but most of it is in this yellow range. The list of genes that you get out in the end is pretty much the same. So the methods robust those decisions. You can see where it breaks down, though, is for very small numbers. So instead of asking for most of the variances to be high, you're getting one. If you're asking for one variance to be really high, then you get a different set of genes out. And that makes sense, because I think at that point you're really asking a different biological question. You're not asking for a disruption that sort of generally disrupts a cell, but you might be having a disruption that increases the variance in one particular process. Okay, so I also want to show you some pictures of what the cells look like. So these are six examples of knockout strains that have phenotypic potentials that are sort of low. They're not significantly high phenotypic potentials. And so the amount of variation in each of these panels is typical of what you would see for wild type yeast cells. And I should point out that this one, for example, ROM1, that mutant has a known average effect on phenotype. So it changes, it affects budding. So even though it has an effect on these cells that a yeast geneticist could pick out, it's not changing the variance of the phenotypes that you see. It's changing their mean. These are six examples of the phenotypic capacitors. And so there are several things I want to point out about these images. So the first is that if you look at this one, say CLA4, what you can see is a wide range of different phenotypes. So here you have an example of what looks like a fairly normal round cell and a fairly normal bud. But you can see that in some examples, the cells take on this sort of angular appearance, irregular cell outlines. In some cases, you have abnormal multiple buds. You have really elongated cells, some roundish cells. And so this is exactly the kind of image we would expect to see from doing our analysis, that Within this genotype, you see a wide range of variation of the shapes of these cells. The other thing to see is that in different genotypes, you see a different constellation of variation. So in this genotype, for example, most of the variation is in cell size, whereas here you see variation in sort of cell shape. And you can sort of draw similar comparisons across all of these that the constellation of shapes that you see is not the same in all of these genotypes, which suggests that there's not just one high-level process called robustness that's being knocked out in different ways, but that you're knocking out different processes and their effect on cell variability is different, but they're all increasing variability. The other thing to notice is sort of the functional categories that these genes fall into. We get sort of a broad representation of functional categories, but a lot of them, as you'll see on the next slide, can be classified into particular categories that are what you would consider as sort of core cellular processes. So transcription, protein modification, chromosome structure. But we do see wide variation within categories and across categories. So these are gene ontology categories, processes that are overrepresented among this list of 500 genes. And so you can see, for example, chromosome organization and biogenesis is an enormously overrepresented category. This includes like chromatin factors, chromosome structure factors. Response to stimulus is overrepresented, cell cycle, RNA elongation, protein modification. And
isn't that the cleavage that he chopped proteins are not there?
Well, so those fall into there. Although I never know when to bring this up, but so it's often asked, well, is HSP90 one of these, right? And the answer is no. And so I don't want to tell you why until I get to a later point, but I think there is a why. Okay, so.
So there is really nothing between this 10 to the minus 25 and 10 to the minus 4?
That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, as people have said before, you know, Go categories are, you know, as good as they are. You know, you're trusting sort of these general annotations. And the real list we get out is, you know, larger than this, and we have to somehow by eye say, you know, these set of categories are really all under this umbrella and these are under this. But I can talk about this category because I think it's a really important category because it includes things that are really deeply involved in gene regulation, right? So chromosome structure, chromosome organization, chromatin factors. But it also includes things that are involved in DNA stability and DNA repair, right? And so it's a really serious question of whether the reason this category is overrepresented is because these are mutator strains, right? So I told you at the beginning that the sources of variation that we're looking at in these experiments are microenvironmental and stochastic variation, but not genetic variation, because these are supposed to be isogenic strains. But if you mutate a gene that causes a mutator phenotype, then you might have genetic variability within that strain, but not in other strains. And so that might be what you're measuring, and that might cause an overrepresentation in this category. So we tried to be really, as best we could, careful to rule that out. And the way we did it is, so all of the data that we used for the analysis came from that OYA screen, right? And that screen was done with haploid yeast knockout library. So what that means is, at some point in time, these genes were knocked out, they were grown up, made into cultures that are sent from lab to lab, individual labs might regrow them up and send them to other labs, and so by the time an assay is done, that strain was mutant for some number of generations that is hard to know, but might be fairly large, right? So we were worried that that could be the cause of variability in these strains that are knocked out for genes that might have a role in DNA repair. So we redid a set of 100 genes to validate these findings, first of all, in our own hands, and, but also to try and control for this possible effect of having mutations accumulate. And so the way we did that was, instead of starting with haploid mutant lines, we used heterozygous diploid lines. So these are basically balanced recessive mutations that are kept in that balanced state until you do your experiment, and then you sporulate the strain. You grow up just for a small number of generations, and you look at the cells. And so if that mutation causes an increase in the mutation rate at other genes, it only has so many generations to have a chance to introduce mutations. And so what was interesting is that we did that repeating. There's a clear difference between genes that were high phenotypic potential before and low phenotypic potential before, which validates the findings. But there was one gene that was noticeably different when we redid it than beforehand, and that was RAD27, which is a known mutator. It really increases the point mutation rate. So that, in a way, is a validation too.
Is cytoskeleton stuff, is that also in this category?
No. So that's one of the missing categories, right? So we don't see an overrepresentation for cytoskeleton, which again is interesting. It suggests that the robustness is at this sort of more fundamental regulatory level, and not at the level of that particular process that might affect cell shape directly. Okay, so what I want to go into next is, well, now we have a list of 500 genes that we're saying are different from the rest of the genome. So what properties do these genes share besides, say, these functional categories? And the most noticeable thing that they share is a high number of network interactions. So on the left here are synthetic lethal genetic interactions. So by definition, these genes are all non-essential, right? You knock them out, but the cells grow. So a synthetic lethal interaction is a measure of how many other things, when they're knocked out simultaneously, cause inviability. And so what you can see is that the capacitors have, on average, more than twice as many synthetic lethal interactions than other non-essential genes. And they also have more protein-protein interactions than other non-essential genes. So this, the comparison of the light gray to the dark gray is the well-known relationship between essentiality and protein-protein interactions. So essential genes tend to have many more protein-protein interactions than non-essential genes, and the capacitors fall in between. So they have a high level of protein-protein interactions compared to non-essential genes. So so this suggests that the genes that are knocked out are in some sense important, right? They're interacting with a lot of other genes, and their protein products are interacting with a lot of other proteins. So this this sort of begs the question of why they're not essential. You know, why is the effect of knocking these things out that you lose robustness rather than you lose the ability to live? And so the first hypothesis that occurred to me was that, well, maybe these have paralogs in the genome that they're partially functionally redundant with. And so if you have two genes with sort of semi-overlapping function, then you might be able to get rid of one or the other and not kill the cells, but what you're left with is sort of a less reliable cellular process, whatever those things are involved in, and so you see that manifest as more variability from cell to cell. And so we could ask the question of whether the genes we're finding as contributing to robustness are more likely to be singletons in the genome, encoded by singletons in the genome, or to be encoded by genes with paralogs.
Can you just remind us how many essential genes do you have in these?
So there are about 6,000 genes in yeast, about 4,700 are not essential, and about 1,300 are essential.
But you've grown these strains with the knockout. So what does it mean to say that they're essential?
Right, so none of the capacitor ones are essential.
Yeah.
Zero.
Good definition.
Right.
What does synthetic lethal mean?
So you take a mutation in one non-essential gene, the cells live. You take a mutation in another non-essential gene, the cells live. But if you have two mutations together, those cells are dead.
In this broad category of chromatin, So there are many different things. So do you see like histones, or you see chromatin remodeling complex, like acetylation and stuff, or what?
Yes.
You see all of that.
Right, so I'll show you a slide towards the very, very end, which shows capacitors that are in chromatin remodeling complexes, the core transcriptional machinery, and you know the RNA polymerase itself, mediator complex. And then there are others. So my favorite capacitor, right? You know, see, so look, you got a list of 500 things you want to look at it carefully. My favorite one is a variant histone called H2AZ. So H2AZ is replaced at basically the plus one nucleosome of repressed genes in yeast and probably in other organisms. And so it's thought to make those nucleosomes easier to eject by acetylation. And so it's sort of a hallmark of repressed genes that are inducible. And so it's known, for example, that when you have a mutation in this gene, certain transcriptional responses are really altered. So the heat shock response, for example, the same genes get turned on, but they get turned on at lower levels. Right. And so it's a kind of thing that can have a really broad transcriptional effect, but again, it's not essential. So my hypothesis was that these capacitors are going to have paralogs in the genome and that there's some partial redundancy going on. And so I was completely wrong about that. So this is just showing you the number of singletons and duplicates or two or more paralogs in the genome for essential genes, capacitor genes, and other non-essential genes. So essential genes, as you might expect, tend to be singletons and not duplicates, right? There's nothing covering for them when they're knocked out. And so it's about a 5-to-1 ratio of singletons to duplicates. Non-essential genes tend to have more duplicates, so it's about 1.5-to-1. And capacitors are more significantly more than other non-essential genes, 2-to-1 singletons to duplicates. So this comparison was the one where I thought we'd be finding a lot of duplicates, but it turns out we were finding more singletons.
Sorry, none of this work. Why are there missing genes?
Right. So there are certain genes that you can't tell unambiguously whether there's a paralog in the genome. Right, there's some sequence out there. You have to set basically a cutoff for your reciprocal blast or whatever you use to assign paralogs, right? And so you have to set some kind of cutoff above which you say, I'm sure that's a paralog. And below another cutoff, you say, I'm sure there's no paralog, but there's this intermediate ground where you just, you don't make a call.
This result is also robust, so if you change those cutoffs, because it is counterintuitive.
Well, I'm going to explain it though. So we didn't spend too much time on this, at least changing those cutoffs. But
do you see huge overrepresentation of paralogs in synthetic lethal experiments? This would suggest that you would.
I think you do. Don't quote me on that, but I think you do. I think you do. Don't quote me on that. Right?
So this ratio is quite consistent with the protein interaction, right? That's sort of perfectly intermediate between two other categories.
Yeah. Although I don't necessarily know whether I think about them the same way because they're intermediate. Okay, so here's the start of what I think is causing this. The fact that I had the wrong answer. And that is that despite this result that surprised us initially, we decided it was worth following up on whether there's some distinction between these singleton capacitors and the duplicate capacitors. If you look at protein-protein interaction degree, the number of protein-protein interactions, for example, this breakdown into singletons and capacitors is really informative because singletons and duplicates is really informative. Because if you look at the duplicates, they have a large number of protein-protein interactions, significantly more than other non-essential duplicates, and many more than just your typical non-essential gene. Whereas the capacitors that are singletons don't have any more protein-protein interactions than non-essential genes at large. Okay, so on that first plot where I showed you, you know, this effect that the protein-protein interactions are elevated in capacitors, that's entirely due to the duplicates and not the singletons.
So, a general question about this protein-protein interaction, right? So, these are these long-tail distributions, right? So when you're showing means, I always get a bit worried that maybe there are just a few guys that push the mean all the way up, and then the statistical significance of the result becomes, you know, because if one guy pushes your mean up because he had a huge number of interactions,
right, right.
I ask, well, is that significant now?
Yeah, so so I have the plots of sort of the binned number of protein-protein interactions. I don't have them on my slides, but I guess I can show them to you later. And we actually don't think it's the case that there's, you know, some small number of outliers.
Yeah, it's around a non-parametric ranking test, right? So it won't be even sensitive.
Yeah, I guess that's true, too.
And you're on a Wilcoxon, so it doesn't matter.
That's true.
For interaction data, these are the hybrids or these are tau or both?
Right, so we've looked at both. For these plots, I'm only showing the pull down mass spec data because we sort of trust them more. And so I guess another answer to your question is one of the things we see, for example, is that the genes with really high numbers of protein-protein interactions are not capacitors. So it's sort of, you know, the medium ones are, but then when you get to really, really high numbers, like HSP90, they're not capacitors anymore. And we think it's because a lot of those are recent duplicates.
So what's the intuition behind this? Sorry, once again, it's kind of... So what's the intuition behind the fact that duplicates have more protein-protein interacting?
There's no intuition yet. I'll sort of keep building the story, and I think by the end there'll be some intuition, hopefully. So this suggested that it's probably worth treating these categories as different, at least, looking at the duplicates separately from the singletons. And so if we sort of pursue the duplicates and try to understand those better, the other thing that's true about them is that the duplicate pairs that include a capacitor tend to be older than the duplicate pairs that don't contain a capacitor. So this is KS, so it's just a measure of age, a measure of divergence. In blue are duplicate pairs that contain a capacitor, and in orange are other non-essential duplicate pairs. And what you can see is that what's missing among the capacitor duplicates is this large number of really young duplicates. Okay, and that, I think, is intuitive because when the duplicates are first formed, they're probably, you know, extremely redundant with each other. And so knocking out one or the other has no phenotypic effect, either at the level of mean phenotype or at the level of variance of phenotypes. And it's only when these things have diverged that they that you can see that sort of functionally at the level of phenotypic variation.
Sorry, but now it gets important how duplicate is defined. Like, do you need to really align along the whole protein, or you just have to have one domain that aligns well?
Yeah, so...
Right,
so... different people have done this, right? And so our strategy was to count on other people's definitions, right? And there are. It's obviously not a trivial thing to define what's a duplicate and what's not a duplicate, but there's not that much disagreement between different people's declarations of what's a duplicate and what's not. And I mean, usually you use some kind of cutoff where there's some amount of significant similarity across at least so many amino acid residues to declare it a duplicate. I mean, I don't know what a better definition would be.
So what's the definition of saying so many young duplicates? you know, essential that are missing for the capacitor?
So these ones would be, you know, very recent duplicates that are probably functionally equivalent, right? And so knocking out one or the other doesn't have any phenotypic effect. That's our interpretation.
So there might be capacitor genes, but you just can't see it in your experiment.
They might have a very small effect on variation.
If the duplicates were not there, they might actually be individually capacitor genes. You just, the setup of the experiment prevents you from seeing it because there's always a backup.
That's right. And so, I mean, the other question, right, is if these things have, you know, a large number of protein interactions, a large number of genetic interactions, the things they're most like are essential genes, right? And so the question is, if you had a hypomorph of an essential gene, would it also give you greater phenotypic variability, right? And so that's something we couldn't test in these experiments because these are knockouts, right? But now there's a collection, for example, of the 1,300 essential genes with their 3' UTRs destabilized. And so you have this now systematic collection of hypomorphs of the essential genes that you could do the same thing on. Our prediction would be that a large number of those would show a change in variation. Or you could do the experiment where you take two genes and knock them out simultaneously in us. So another distinguishing feature of the duplicate pairs that contain a capacitor is that they tend to have much lower expression similarity across conditions than other duplicate pairs. So these are duplicate pairs that contain an essential gene, these are duplicate pairs that contain non-essential genes, and these are duplicate pairs that contain a capacitor. And this is a measure of expression similarity that's just basically a correlation across a large number of conditions that was calculated from this paper. And so what you can see is that the lowest similarity, significantly, is for the capacitor duplicate pairs. They've diverged most in their expression across conditions than other paralogous pairs. And that doesn't just have to do with age, right? So, you know, I showed you here that the capacitors, on average, are older because they're lacking these young duplicates. So you might be able to explain this difference by just the age of the duplicates, that they've diverged in expression sort of proportional to their age. But essential duplicate pairs are old, too, as you might expect. And so the capacitor duplicate pairs are actually more divergent in expression than the essential duplicate pairs, even though they're, you know, they're sort of matched in age.
But they might be even older.
I think they might even be older.
See, there's this huge body of literature on evolutional duplicates. And in terms of expression, there are, I think, several viewpoints. So one viewpoint is that it's all near-functionalization, or it's sub-functionalization, or specialization, or whatever. And the other viewpoint is that it's point dispersion for dosage, for just trace dose. Say, do you think it's feasible that in this plot is, in essential genes, probably it's not those because they just wouldn't be essential otherwise. So it's just different mode of evolution for the duplicating genes.
Well, right. So one way to interpret the essential genes is subfunctionalization, right? That they've divided up which conditions they're expressed in, but the function itself is essential.
Right. So you expect hyperrelation and expression, but different functions. So we're not different functions. Well, different subfunctions.
Well, I was making the case for regulatory subfunctionalization, right? So that, right, the function of the protein is exactly the same, but they've divided up when they're expressed, right? That's a kind of subfunctionalization.
Okay.
Right, you can think of, the classic example is if you have a gene that has two enhancers and it duplicates, one of them retains one enhancer, the other one retains the other enhancer, and that's subfunctionalization, right? So that would be consistent with a low expression similarity, but each gene is still essential, right? So the capacitors have even lower expression similarity, right? But they're not essential, so you need a different kind of explanation that I think, well, I mean, again, this is something that we'll sort of build up to and maybe get a more of an intuition about. but I think it has to do with that the function itself really isn't essential, that it really has more to do with fidelity and not viability.
Is it typically the case that if you have a capacitor to put there, that they're both capacitors, or is it typically only one of the two?
I'll get to that too. Yeah. Or maybe I'm trying to remember if I have that slide in there. But there are 60 something pairs that are, so we looked at, because the other problem you run into, right, is there are some with, 10 paralogs, there are some with 3 paralogs. And so for the analysis I'm going to show you soon, we wanted to look at real pairs. So there's only 2 paralogs. And one of them is a capacitor and the other one is not. And so to get that set, we started with all the pairs that contain at least one capacitor. And I think we only had to throw out like 4 or so that were 2 capacitors. So there's not over-representation there. And I think you'll see why when I get to that part.
When you refer to essential pairs, that means both duplicates are essential, and when you refer to capacitor pairs, mean both?
No, this is a duplicate pair that includes at least one capacitor, or at least one essentially. So this is the comparison that I was just talking about. So if we take cases where there are exactly 2 paralogs, a real duplicate pair where there's not other paralogs that go along with them, and we compare the and we take only the ones where there's one capacitor and one non-capacitor. Okay, and we ask, are there any differences between the capacitor side of the pair and the non-capacitor side of the pair? There are. So the capacitor, so here we have capacitors, and that capacitor is paralog, and there's only one paralog. And if we look at expression levels, either by mRNA abundance or protein abundance, the one that's the capacitor is significantly higher expressed. Okay? And the one that's a capacitor has significantly more genetic interactions, synthetic lethal interactions, many more on average.
So how do you compare expression between 2 genes?
These are just absolute levels. So you have the genes, your 60 genes that are the capacitors, your 60 genes that are the not capacitor, that's the paralog, and you just take their absolute levels of expression that we measure. So this to us suggested a model for how these duplicate capacitors are forming. And that is that there's some ancestral gene that has some number of genetic interactions, which I'm sort of signifying in orange, some number of protein-protein interactions, which I'm denoting in white. And so there's a duplication event. So then you have 2 paralogs. Initially, they both have the same protein-protein interactions, and by definition, there are now no synthetic lethal interactions, because if these 2 are perfectly redundant, then either one of them has no synthetic lethal interactions with other things except each other. They might, but if we assume that this was not an essential gene, then there are, right after the duplication, if the whole gene gets duplicated, there's no synthetic lethal interaction. And then these things start to diverge, and it looks like that happens asymmetrically, right? So it looks like one of the genes is expressed higher and has more interactions, and the other one has fewer. And so the one becomes the capacitor, and it has it retains those genetic interactions and the protein interactions, and the other one becomes less important and might lose interactions physically and genetically. And so this one's the capacitor, and then the other one's not. I'm wondering if and when we should take a break. So it's sort of like there's not a great stopping point. So I don't know how people feel. We can stop it. What I'm saying is we could stop at any point and just take a break.
How much should we?
Yeah. I mean, I only have like six or seven more slides. Okay. Okay, so that's our model for what's going on with the duplicates, that they're sort of asymmetrically diverging after the duplication event, and one of them is taking on more of the responsibility. So when you knock that one out, the other one can cover at least for whatever essential function that pair might share, but you lose some kind of reliability. You lose robustness. Whereas the other one, you knock it out, and there's no detectable effect on anything, on phenotypic variation. So next we wanted to go back and look at the singletons. and if this sort of partial redundancy is our model for why a duplicate capacitor might be a capacitor, then it's harder to conceive for a singleton of what the level of redundancy is, right? So if the same story holds, that there's some other function out there that can cover for the loss of one of these genes, but not perfectly, so you lose reliability, then how would that, what would be your candidates for a singleton gene? And so what we looked at first was the location of these genes in the protein interaction network. And what we found is that the capacitors that are singletons tend to have higher clustering coefficients on average. That is, their neighbors in the protein interaction network tend to be connected to each other, as opposed to just this sort of spoke-like structure. And they tend to have low betweenness centrality. So betweenness centrality is just the proportion of shortest paths through the network that have to pass through that node. And so a high betweenness would be that you're sort of a connection point between different modules. And a low betweenness means you're somehow sort of more peripheral in the network. And so the singletons have, on average, lower betweenness centrality than the capacitors have, on average, lower betweenness centrality than the other non-essential singletons. So that suggests that these singletons are within protein modules, right? They're connected to things that are connected to each other, and they don't have a high betweenness, so they're not sort of connecting module to module. They're just sort of present within a module.
There are a few questions, just maybe a little technical. So these are DAP cell zone data. And in cell zone data, it's not a complete complex, because they're not providing directions. And obviously, they didn't use all proteins as bonds, right, as bases. Yeah. So they use bulk model for complexes. So this is the first question, is what's in terms of centrality, how much of that is simply the fact that another protein was used as a bait for the same complex, right, and this gives high centrality. The other question is, in terms of betweenness, is it a correct understanding that these things are more frequently are parts of different complexes pulled down separately? So this is what, with respect to mass spec data, is betweenness, right?
Yes. Okay. Right. And so for the question on bait and prey, for the mass spec data, it's actually not that much of a problem. It's something like half or more of yeast proteins have actually been used as bait. So it's actually a bigger problem for the synthetic lethal interaction network, where only about 300 genes have been used as bait. And so in those comparisons, we always controlled for whether something was used as bait or something was only used as prey.
I'm not clear how you would interpret this clear spoke in mass spec data, because if you have a protein complex, and if this is a stable complex, then it's a click on the ground. Right? So, would this just mean that there are many small complexes which don't interact with each other? Because it seems that
right.
should be very high in this data.
Right, yeah, and I'm sure that it's higher than if you just use two hybrid data to calculate the same thing.
Yeah.
Right, but as you said, it probably has to do with, differences probably have to do with sort of the stability of the entire complex and whether you have subcomplexes within a complex, and so you don't always pull down the whole thing, right? Because if you believe the two hybrid, then when you pull down any one member, you should pull down every protein in the cell, right? Because the giant component of the two hybrid graph is basically all proteins. So there are other features of the singletons that set them apart. So one thing we looked at was if the protein neighborhood of these things seems to be important, and then that suggests that maybe their neighbors have special properties, not just the capacitor themselves. And so we looked at the properties of the neighbors of these singleton capacitors, and they tend to have certain properties on average compared to proteins at large. They're more likely to be essential. So the neighbors of the capacitors are more likely to be essential genes. If they're not essential, they tend to have more synthetic lethal interactions. And if they're not essential, they tend to cause greater decreases in growth rate when deleted. So they're either essential or highly deleterious when knocked out, and they have a large number of genetic interactions. And they also tend to have higher phenotypic potential or tend to have identity as capacitors themselves. So the capacitors tend to cluster as well. So I just want to summarize all these things in two ways. So first is just with some sentences. We found our estimate of true positives is about 300 or so gene products that are required to buffer these either microenvironmental fluctuations or stochastic effects. They're found in diverse processes in the cell, but they're enriched in certain ones, especially chromosome organization and also RNA elongation, protein modification, stress response. They tend to have, whether they're singletons or duplicates, they tend to have a lot of genetic interactions as measured by synthetic lethal interactions. If they are duplicates, then they tend to have a lot of protein interactions, and you see this asymmetric divergence with their paralogs, where they tend to have a big difference in expression across conditions, greater abundance of mRNA and protein, and more interactions. And
I just now realized that you only showed us then synthetic lethal interactions, not protein-protein interactions. So is it also true that if you have a paralogous pair and that the capacitor has more protein-protein interactions than the then it's
paralogous? I don't remember. I'll look it up for you.
One question just came to my mind. When you're comparing these duplicates, one of whom is the capacitor, are they more diverse from each other than duplicates where neither of them is a capacitor, similar age?
At the level of expression? Or?
The sort of things you compare, like, you take two genes that are paralogs but are not capacitors, do they show less divergence, more divergence?
Right, so that was that one. So the expression divergence is this picture. This one,
okay.
Right?
All right, so.
And I guess I'd have to check on, like, whether there's that much. Well, so the problem, right, is, I guess you could look at how much divergence there is in sort of abundance of mRNA or abundance of protein, but you'd have to do it in a different way than I presented, because a priori there's no, if you're looking at just two paralogs, neither of which is a capacitor, there's no asymmetry of labels beforehand. You don't have one capacitor and one not. So I guess you'd have to look at some kind of, you know, measure of the distance between the two and see. You know. And so the ones that are singletons tend to be part of more interconnected modules, and the other members, their neighbors in those modules, tend to be more important, either, you know, as measured by essentiality or synthetic lethal interactions or growth rates. And so another way of summarizing these things is to show you one of these sort of network neighborhoods. So this is all of the first degree neighbors of the mediator complex. So this is an essential complex in transcriptional activation. And as you can see, its network neighborhood includes RNA polymerase II. It includes the TF2D complex, which includes TATA binding protein. So this is sort of the core general transcription factors. And then the neighborhood also includes two chromatin remodeling complexes, NO80 and SwitchSNF.
So these capacitors you're showing us here, these are the representative members of these classes in the clustering procedure. Are they? Do these clusters, do they also correspond? Oh, no, sorry. You're clustering by phenotypes.
Right. So the color coding here is non-essential genes are in white, essential genes are in dark gray. The singleton capacitors are in light blue, the duplicate capacitors are in dark blue, and then capacitors where we couldn't unambiguously say whether there was a paralog present are in pink. And so what you can see, for example, is in all five of these complexes, there are essential proteins. As you might expect, you need RNA polymerase to transcribe genes, you need this coactivation complex to do that, and so on. But there are also some non-essential genes, and you can see these light blue circles tend to be inside these modules, right? And so those are the singleton capacitors, the ones that sort of have these higher clustering coefficients and lower between essentiality, and that's sort of consistent with the way I described it before, that the singletons tend to belong inside these protein modules. Whereas the dark blue ones, like a great example here is TAF14, connect these modules. In other words, as Shamil was saying, if you pull down TAF14, you're going to get these guys, and these guys. And that shows as this really large number of protein-protein interactions, which are highlighted in orange here. This kind of position in the network is a high betweenness position, right? Because the connections between these things can go through TAP14.
Maybe I have one question about this. This figure. So there are many other complexes interacting with AZ and distance delays, and like there is a whole bunch of them. So are they out there? So they're not represented, or this is just the cells of the data? Data you don't see this interaction.
Right. So the way this was constructed is to take all of the members of the mediator complex and their first degree neighbors. And the only thing we took off of these are there are some nodes that only had one interaction, and so we just got rid of those. But if there's some complex missing that would normally interact with these things, it's because it doesn't connect through the mediator complex.
What does this TAF14 do?
So TAFs were generally originally identified as part of TF2D. But it's known, for example, that in transcriptional activation, a lot of contacts to RNA polymerase are actually mediated either through the mediator complex or through the general transcription factors of the TF2D complex. And so TAF14 has alternatively been described as a member of this complex, this complex, this complex, this complex, and this complex.
It's sort of a cofactor for...
Yeah. I don't know if you look at, and that's a good question, I don't know if you look at its protein sequence, what type of protein it looks like, you know? At least it's described as basically a cofactor for all of these complexes.
I know that some of proteins, which are like that if you look at the sequence, they have WD40 or scaffolding that makes for protein interactions. So they basically structural components which can assemble different complexes. So just use some of the like that.
All right, so I just want to sort of give you some indication of where we're going next with this. I think it'll be really important to look at other sources of variation, in particular if we're interested in what the relevance of capacitance might be for evolution, then what we really need to concern ourselves with is how genetic variation interacts with these things and whether the same genes that buffer microenvironmental variation also buffer genetic sources of variation. This is a hypothesis that's been given the name the congruence hypothesis, which basically states that genetic buffering is, it's really hard to imagine how that would evolve because whatever selection pressure there is to evolve genetic buffering is weak, and there's a very circumscribed set of parameter values for the strength of selection and the amount of polymorphism that would actually favor it, whereas buffering against environmental variation should be ubiquitous and increases in strength with the amount of environmental variation. And so one explanation for why we might observe genetic buffering is that it's just a side product of evolving robustness against environmental variation. And so it's important to test whether the same genes that buffer sources of environmental variation also buffer genetic variation. And so we're in the process of setting up to test that by introducing these knockouts into a set of genetically diverse strains that all that are basically mutation accumulation strains that derive from the same common ancestor. We're also interested in looking at macroenvironmental variation. In particular, I think I have it on the next slide, we're interested in the question of whether this generation of variability might be adaptive, especially in harsh environments. And so the logic goes that if you're wild type and you have this narrow range of variation, then if you experience some environment that's really hard to deal with, none of the cells in your population will be able to deal with it. But if you're a more variable genotype, then there might be this sort of rare cell survival going on where you generate enough variability that some small proportion of cells are out in the tail and can actually deal with whatever environmental insult is in this harsh environment. And so I think I'll just go to that point more specifically. One of the nice sort of validations of the genes we found came from sort of an unexpected source. So Simon Avery had been doing experiments with mutations in yeast that lead to that were initially isolated as stress-sensitive mutations. So you do a screen, you put the cells on bad medium, and some mutants die. And so these are identified as stress-sensitive mutations. But what he realized was that a fraction of these were actually could do better than the wild type at high stressor concentrations. And they were mostly looking at oxidative stress and heavy metal stress. And so this is an example of one of those genes, VMA3. And so this is basically a survival curve. The white is the wild type, and the dark circles are this VMA3 mutant over a range of pH conditions. And you can see that the wild type has a really steep dose response curve. So at about pH 8 something, all the cells die, right? And there's a very quick transition between the cells being perfectly fine and the cells being all dead. Whereas the mutant, under these sort of moderately bad pHs, is clearly doing worse than the wild type, but at the really high pHs, does better than the wild type. And this is a logarithmic scale, so this difference is pretty big. And so the interpretation is that, first of all, this shallower dose response curve is indicative of cellular heterogeneity. That is, for a particular value of pH, different cells are experiencing it differently. Right, some are living, some are dying. And this observation that these dose response curves cross suggests that this variability contributes to this sort of rare cell survival effect. And So they studied six genes that had this property, and four out of the six we found to be capacitors in our screen. So in a completely different measurement of variability, our measurement was variability in morphology, and theirs was in stress response, you see that these same genes show up. And so we're interested in looking for other capacitor knockouts of whether they have these same kind of effects and whether in certain...
Were these four part of the 100 that you validated independently?
I don't know which ones are and which ones aren't. But our validation rate was very, very, you know...
Just to exclude the probability that these four actually are involved in the mutational process.
Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence that they are. The ones they study, I think, I don't know if all of them, but most of them are involved in vacuole function. So we want to look in other sort of environments to see if there are such effects. And we've already seen that. So this H2AZ, for example, if you grow it on really high concentrations of nickel or cobalt, which would kill wild-type cells, these guys survive. Right? And we want to do this fairly systematically to do a range of environments, gradients of these toxin concentrations and these knockouts to see whether this variability that's produced can actually be adaptive. The other question that goes back to the original Rutherford and Lindquist images of HSP90 mutant flies is that, you know, some people look at those images and they see monsters, right? You wouldn't even call them hopeful monsters. They're like hopeless monsters, right? A fly without an eye or a bad abdomen or a bad wing is just not fit, right? And so there was sort of some extreme doubt, especially from the evolutionary genetics community, about whether this phenomenon of releasing variation in this way could ever contribute to evolution, because you might just be, you know, yeah, you're revealing variation, but none of it is fit, right? I think it's important to find cases like this where you might actually be able to describe a scenario in which, you know, this variation could be adaptive. Another case that sort of came out of our list of genes is these guys did a systematic screen in yeast for mutations that promote haploid invasive growth. So these are cells that dig into the agar substrate. So it's a really easy assay. You let the cells grow, you wash off the surface of the plate just under a tap, and then you see if they grow back. And if they grow back, it's because they were able to dig into the agar, and wild-type cells normally do that, most lab yeast strains. And so they found 27 knockouts that promote haploid invasive growth, and 12 of those show up as capacitors. And on one of the slides, you saw one of those, which actually isn't on their list, but we actually saw did this is SWI6, which showed that those sort of pseudo hyphal like growth patterns. So invasive growth is obviously also a potentially very adaptive phenotype, whether it's digging into a grape or digging into pathogenic strains, digging into host tissue. This is potentially also a very adaptive phenotype. And then obviously the other thing we can look at in our data is that each knockout has been measured, its growth rate has been measured in rich medium. So we can just ask the question of what's the average effect of knocking out one of these genes on growth rate. So on average, they do tend to grow less quickly than wild type cells. But it's not a big effect. And 80% of the knockouts have growth rates greater than 80% of wild type. 25% of the knockouts have as good a growth rate as wild type in rich medium. And so that suggests, again, that you're not always creating monsters when you're creating greater variability. Now, every population geneticist should say, well, if your growth rate is 80% of wild type, then in competition with wild type, you know, you're not going to last very long, right? But we think that the sort of life history of yeast provides a mechanism where even this kind of differential in growth rate could be mitigated by whatever advantage that the variability produces. And the reason is that if you look at the growth rates of heterozygous diploids, for these mutations, they have absolutely no difference with wild type. So they're sort of perfectly recessive. Wild type cells grow at the same rate as heterozygotes for these mutations. And in the wild, yeast live as diploids. They hit harsh conditions and they sporulate and create haploids. And those haploids either immediately mate with each other and become diploid again, or some percentage of strains in the wild actually persist as haploids for some small amount of time and then mate and become diploids. Their preference when conditions are good is to be diploid. And so this provides a potential mechanism where this capacitance could actually play a role in adaptation, or at least in weathering bad times for yeast. And that is that you maintain one of these mutations as in heterozygous form as a diploid. Things are great. Go right along. Conditions get bad and you sporulate. Half the spores will be mutant for one of these and half the spores won't for that particular locus. The wild type ones will be whatever they are, but they'll have sort of narrow variability. The mutant ones will have greater variability. And so if conditions really are bad and you're in a situation where, say, rare cell survival is really the name of the game, then the mutant ones could be the ones that that persist and outcompete the wild type in that environment.
Once haploids? This is haploids.
As haploids. So there's some percentage of yeast cells that can't do mating type switching. So they'll persist as haploids. The ecology of yeast is a sort of weak field, right? We'd love to know more about it. But at least in principle, there is about 30% of strains that do persist as haploids.
So, just in case you know, so what you're describing is similar to this geometric mean fitness argument in fluctuating environments. So is this like purely applicable to yeast, and we can look at the environments and see, or they are sexual enough and there are some complications in this?
So sex in yeast is very rare. It's I think it's been estimated at like 1 in 50,000 generations you have recombination. Not per population, but for per cell division generation.
Right? So it's a fair statement that if my environment fluctuates and one of these accounts improves geometric mean fitness, it will basically fix on the population, right? That's what you're suggesting.
And actually, I mean, what could happen, and this leads to a prediction, although, you know, I don't know if I'd be gathering a field team to test the prediction, but the prediction would be that you would have some kind of genetic assimilation, too, so that the mutant might persist just long enough to do better during that bad time. But then eventually it could actually mate with a wild-type haploid and restore the heterozygous diploid, which is going to be more advantageous than a homozygous diploid. Over time, on average, what you would expect to see is heterozygotes for these genes. And if we can find a place where grapes are growing in, you know, a toxic dump or something, then, you know, we might be able to test and say, well, is there a higher heterozygosity of these genes than other genes or something?
But, Could you just say something about how these 79 and 25% compare with non-essential knockouts that are not capacitors?
Right. So I don't know the exact percentages here, but I do know that if you just take the average growth rate of the capacitors and compare it to the average growth rate of other non-essential genes, it's lower for capacitors.
Okay. So it's on average bad for you.
It's on average bad for you. That's an average across all capacitor mutations, right? So for a particular capacitor mutation, it might be just as good as wild type and just as good as any other non-essential gene knockout.
No, I understand.
Okay. All right, so I just wanted to thank Sasha again, who is a really great scientist who did all the work that I showed you today. The rest of my lab, Joanna Mazel is a collaborator at University of Arizona who we're collaborating on some modeling work that I didn't talk about. Maitreya Dunham was really helpful for us getting started with yeast, because neither Sasha nor I had ever worked with yeast before, and so we needed some help, but once you get started, it's really easy. So I'd encourage everyone to just, you know, start a yeast lab. We have some really great colleagues in the Center for Genomics and Systems Biology in the biology department at NYU. It's, I think, a really great mix of people who are interested in evolutionary questions and people who are interested in sort of systems biology and genomics. And I also have to thank these guys for giving money to me and these guys for giving money to Sasha.
You didn't keep your word to tell us anything, something about HSP90.
Oh, right. So HSP90 does not show up as a capacitor in our screen. In fact, it has a really low phenotypic potential. But the reason, I think, is that there's two HSP90s in yeast. They're a recent duplicate pair. And so they fall into that category of covering for each other. And actually, there's a paper by Leah Cowan on HSP90 in yeast, and I think she set out to do the same type of HSP90 experiment that was done in flies and in Arabidopsis, where you impair HSP90 function and you expect to see greater variability, sort of buffered variation that's then revealed. And she actually saw the opposite. So impairment of, or HSP90 function actually allows new mutations to have effect, was her finding, right? So it's sort of the opposite of capacitance. And I think the difference was the type of mutations, partly the type of mutations they were assaying. They were assaying strains that were under really strong selection. So the variation there could have been these alleles with really dramatic effects. And if you didn't have HSP90 there, these proteins would get misfolded or something and just not be viable. So I think there's still a question of whether there's some way to perturb HSP90 function in yeast and get this sort of buffering effect manifest. But I think the reason we didn't see it is because they're paralogs, very close paralogs.
Would it be possible, one of the things that I think is still a little bit difficult in interpreting the results is that everything is based on this phenotype, which is, you know, these 220 numbers that are gotten from these pictures, right? And so would it be possible to look at growth rate itself as a phenotype and how much that varies within, you know, the same genotype?
Right. So what we're doing now is trying to develop a similar protocol that looks at live cells. So we would use fluorescent reporters encoded on a plasmid, basically, that would do the cell, show the cell shape, show the nucleus, and show the emerging bud site. And there are really good markers in yeast that do this. And so what that would allow us to do is to plate these cells in liquid medium, but on, you know, sort of attached to the bottom of a optical microplate. So you can microscope through it and grow a bunch of cultures in parallel. And what you would have would be, you know, plating at low density, you would have a single cell at first, it would bud again. And you could actually calculate growth rate directly from that. And you can actually do a much better job, I think, of binning these cell cycle stages so that you get more precise measurements of everything. And by doing that, I think we could switch from just measuring arbitrary things like lengths and angles and stuff to sort of a more standard morphometrics approach, which would involve superimposition of shapes and using least squared distances between the whole shape.
Could you also do something like you measure the variance of the distribution of times between buddings?
Well, right.
Which
right.
would be a measure of how growth rate varies across individuals in the population.
Right, no, that's exactly right. And we could look at epigenetic inheritance of that, if there is. You know, I don't think anybody knows whether that exists to any extent and whether mutations could change it. But yeah, there are a few goals of trying to move to a different imaging platform. One is higher throughput. So if you can look at live cells, then you avoid this three-day staining and handling procedure that really slows you down. You can also do it in microplates, which and have the microscope do the work for you overnight. And you don't have to wait as long because you're looking at these sort of micro colonies. So you can do in a few hours instead of growing cultures through exponential phase. But then the other advantage is looking at these budding events and epigenetic inheritance and things like that and getting better measurements of the cells.